My topic today is the geopolitics of energy, or more specifically, the new geopolitics of energy. The need for energy has trapped us in an increasingly bitter geopolitical struggle over the world's remaining supplies of energy.
Hope everybody has taken note of the remaining events in October and November. We got a lot of cool stuff going on, and we hope you all can come back and be with us every week. A couple of announcements. We welcome today some students who are visiting from Dabney Lancaster Community College. We really want to acknowledge and thank our good friend Jack Brown and Bill Hall from the Department of Science, Technology, and Society here at the University of Virginia, who have worked very closely with us and are co-hosting our speaker today. A book signing with both of the speakers' most recent books will follow the forum. So at the end of the program, let me ask that everybody remain in their seats until our speaker has left so he can get out there and get where he can sign books that we hope all of you will avail yourselves of the opportunity to purchase before leaving today. Actually, I read the Blood and Oil book over the weekend. It's very, very impressive. So I urge people to get both of these and read them, and they'll be on the test. The test will be tomorrow afternoon. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. 44 years ago, Amherst College, Hampshire College, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and University of Massachusetts at Amherst formed a unique cooperative called Five Colleges Incorporated to attract and make available to their all five institutions some of the leading scholars in the country. We are pleased today to host one of the five college professors, Michael Clare. Michael Clare has, since 1985, been the Five Colleges Professor of Peace and World Security Studies. He was educated at Columbia University and the Graduate School of the Union Institute, and he was director of the Program on Militarism and Disarmament at the Institute for Policy Studies from 1977 to 1984. His work on United States defense policy, the arms trade, and world security issues very recently has focused on control of resources, including sovereign control of resources, and the conflicts that have arisen over increasingly scarce resources. He's published widely, including three recent books, Resource Wars, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependence, and most recently, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. So please welcome Michael Clare.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming out on this beautiful day. It's such a gorgeous day, and I'm very happy to be here to talk about this topic with you, and I'm very honored to be at the Miller Center. So my topic today is the geopolitics of energy, or more specifically, the new geopolitics of energy, which is the subtitle of my new book. I believe that the geopolitics of energy will increasingly dominate international affairs and American foreign policy, no matter who's elected president in 2 weeks, and no matter how deep and prolonged the current economic crisis. That's because energy, having a sufficient supply of energy, is absolutely essential to the health of our economy. And the need for energy has trapped us in an increasingly bitter geopolitical struggle over the world's remaining supplies of energy. And this is the themes that I want to discuss with you today. First, a few words about geopolitics in general and energy geopolitics in particular. By geopolitics, I mean the intersection of economics, trade, geography, and traditional state interests. Now, historically, the field that we know of today as international relations in academia, or IR, as it's often called, used to be considered geopolitics. That's what you would have studied 100 or 75 years ago. And the leading practitioners in the field believed that world affairs were largely driven by a struggle between states for control over valuable sources of raw materials and the critical supply lines that connected these supplies with manufacturing centers and markets around the world. That's what drove world affairs. There was no question in anybody's mind about that. One of the greatest proponents of this perspective was an American naval officer, Alfred Thayer Mahon, who was president of the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the mentor of Theodore Roosevelt, then the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Mahon argued that the acquisition of a powerful navy and overseas colonies was essential to America's rise as a great power, and he had great influence on the leaders of his day. He also had great influence on another Roosevelt president, FDR, who was also Assistant Secretary of the Navy before he became president. But these views declined during the Cold War period when ideology was assumed to be the most important factor in world affairs. Today, however, the geopolitical perspective is again rising to the fore in international relations as ideology wanes as a factor in world affairs, and again, resources, trade, and economics dominate the international agenda. Indeed, when John McCain speaks of his indebtedness to Theodore Roosevelt, as he does very often, he's really speaking of Mahon's influence on U.S. strategic thinking. By the way, if you want to find where Mahon's works are still featured in the curriculum of the major military academies of a world power, the place to look is not in the United States, but in China, where his views are highly regarded and are still being taught, and where his thought is having a considerable influence as China rises as a major world power and worries about its access to overseas resources and markets. So geopolitics is about the intersection of economics, geography, and state interests. And as I've tried to suggest, its insights appear to be getting fresh attention as the economic dimensions of international affairs again take central stage. So what then do I mean by energy geopolitics? By energy geopolitics, I mean the ways in which the international competition for access to vital supplies of energy has been taken over by state authorities and has defined the political, diplomatic, and military relations between states. As the global demand for energy has risen and global supplies have failed to grow in tandem, national leaders have become increasingly anxious about their ability to secure adequate supplies of energy to meet the needs of their industries, their militaries, and their populations. Every consuming country must now compete with other consuming nations for access to an increasingly insufficient supply of primary fuels, producing a fierce struggle over what remains of the world's supply of primary energy. The resulting anxiety has been exacerbated, moreover, by the increased control exercised by the major producing countries like Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela over the global output and transportation of energy supplies. These producing countries are certainly benefiting by the increased demand for their products, but they don't have the same strategic interests as the energy consuming countries. In fact, in some cases, their interests collide with us. All of this has produced a fresh outbreak of geopolitical contestation among the major energy consumers and producers, with control over key oil and gas supplies and transit routes the primary objective. As in past rounds of geopolitical competition, moreover, this current outbreak has entailed a military as well as financial and diplomatic dimensions. A significant case in point is the recent fighting in the Caucasus in August of this year. This conflict did not originate, as we were told, in the past few months and years, when Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, began a campaign to regain control over the breakaway enclaves of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, thus irritating the Russians, who had backed the separatists as a way of asserting their influence over the region. No, the roots of this conflict lie in a decision by the Clinton administration in the mid-1990s to convert Georgia into an energy corridor for the transportation of Caspian Sea oil and natural gas to Western markets, bypassing Russia, which at that time possessed the only pipelines connecting the Caspian area to Europe. The Caspian is landlocked, so the only way to get energy out of the region is by pipeline. Clinton wanted to ensure that the West would have an alternative route to Caspian energy, not dependent on Russia, and so he personally backed the construction of a new pipeline, the BTC, or Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, from Baku on the Caspian Sea coast of Azerbaijan to Ceyhan on Turkey's Mediterranean coast through Georgia, and then turned Georgia into a military protectorate of the United States in order to ensure the safety of the pipeline. This happened during the tenure of President Edward Shevardnadze, no paragon of democratic values. And retaliation, and to demonstrate its abiding sway in the region, Russia backed the separatists in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. This is where things stood when Saakashvili took office and vowed to restore Georgian control over the enclaves. Encouraged by neoconservatives around Dick Cheney and John McCain, he attacked the capital of South Ossetia, on August 7th, giving Russia an excuse to counterattack and clobber the Georgian army, and demonstrate just how vulnerable the BTC pipeline is in the process, and to discourage the EU from building still more pipelines through Georgia. This, I think, is the essence of what the conflict in the Caucasus was all about. It was a geopolitical struggle over energy, not a political struggle. And this is just one example of the growing significance of energy geopolitics and international affairs. Another example is the growing importance of Africa, the fastest growing source of oil for both the United States and China. Just this month, the U.S. Department of Defense created the Africa Command, AFRICOM, the first new overseas military command to be established by the Department of Defense since 1983. When Ronald Reagan created the Central Command to protect the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. I believe that developments like these are characteristics of a world in which energy geopolitics will play an increasingly central role in international affairs and will prove an increasingly sharp source of international friction and conflict. Now, why is this so? Why has energy geopolitics come to generate, to dominate world affairs, and why is it likely to generate friction and crisis? The answer to these questions, I believe, lie in the title of my new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. What we see in the world today is an extraordinary convergence of two powerful trends. First, the rise of a new cohort of dynamic economic powers in the developing world, especially China and India, with a ravenous thirst for energy supplies. And second, a slowdown in the capacity of the world energy industry to satisfy the soaring demand of these new energy consumers, along with that of the older energy consumers like the United States, Europe, and Japan. Let me elaborate briefly on these two points. Until as recently as 1990, the developing nations of Asia, including China and India, consumed a relatively small share of world energy. In 1990, that was only 13%. But so rapid has been the economic growth of these countries and so prodigious their demand for energy that by 2005, their consumption of energy, of world energy, had risen to 24% of the global total, an extraordinary jump in just 15 years, nearly double. And if current trends continue to prevail, developing Asia will account for 33% of world energy consumption in 2025, far more than any other region of the world. By this time, moreover, China will have overtaken the United States to be the world's number one consumer of energy, a truly revolutionary change in the global energy equation. The United States, of course, will continue to be needing more energy in this period. So if you combine soaring energy demand by China, India, and other developing countries, along with continuing high levels of demand from the United States, Europe, and Japan, you're going to see a very huge increase in overall energy demand over the next quarter of a century, as much as 50%, according to the US Department of Energy, 50% increase in demand. Now, none of this would be a source of great anxiety if we had any expectation that the world's energy producers were capable of increasing their output of oil, natural gas, coal, and other fuels in tandem with this 50% increase in demand, as they have done in the past. But this is where the problem lies. Energy experts today have no confidence whatsoever that the industry is capable of achieving a 50% increase in supply. Why this is so takes some explanation, more than we have time for in the minutes that I have allotted. But let me give you the bare bones outline. Essentially, we have now used up the world's most prolific and easy to get at reserves of oil, natural gas, coal, uranium, and water power, leaving only the less attractive, harder to get at reserves. This doesn't mean we're running out of any of these materials, not yet, anyway. What it does mean is that each additional barrel of oil or cubic feet of gas will be harder and more costly to produce and will entail increased political, military, and environmental risk. Take oil. The world now uses about 85 million barrels of oil per day, up from 67 million barrels per day in 1990. Assuming current trends continue to prevail, world demand will reach an estimated 107 million barrels per day in 2025. But will the world be capable of supplying 107 million barrels per day in 2025? I greatly doubt it. There are several reasons to be skeptical of this. First, many of the world's existing fields have been in continuous production for 30, 40, 50, or 60 years and are beginning to show signs of extreme fatigue, pumping out less and less oil every day. At the same time, the major oil companies are exploring increasingly intensively around the world to find new oil and are finding less and less each year. And if you continue to use more and more oil every day and your existing fields are in decline and you're finding less and less oil each day, sooner or later there's going to be a day of reckoning when the world oil producers can no longer increase their daily output of oil, you reach a peak or a maximum output, and you begin to go into decline. There's a lot of debate about when this moment will come, but most energy experts believe it will come far before 2025, when the Department of Energy says we'll need 107 million barrels a day, and it will fall far short of that level. So somewhere in the next few years, we're going to reach a maximum amount of oil available and then go into decline. There's only one way to have any expectation of even raising above the 85 million barrel a day level, and that's to accelerate the development of output in problematic oil zones like Iraq, Iran, Nigeria, Sudan, Colombia, Venezuela, Russia, and Central Asia. Not a very promising panorama. Now, I've just written a book about the obstacles to raising output in these areas, and it would take the rest of the morning to do justice to all of these problems. But the list includes terrorism, insurgency, civil war, corruption, anti-Americanism, authoritarianism, and crony capitalism. That's true of all the countries on this list. This is not an environment in which Western oil companies are well suited to operate, especially when they are obliged to obey domestic laws requiring transparency, respect for human rights, and limits on bribery. On the other hand, it's a world in which governments accustomed to overlooking these problems are able to operate relatively successfully, as China has demonstrated in Sudan, Uzbekistan, and Zimbabwe. It's also a world that has favored the rise of Gazprom, the state-controlled natural gas monopoly of Russia, which has taken control of pipelines in neighboring countries, giving it possession of the world's largest network of natural gas pipelines, extending throughout Europe, much of Europe, and Asia. In sum, this is an environment that favors geopolitical struggle and a shift in power from the older consuming nations to the new, but not to an increase in the global supply of energy. All this being the case, we could assume that the global supply of energy will not be sufficient to meet anticipated global requirements in the years ahead, and that we can expect an increasingly fierce competition among the major consuming nations for whatever supplies are available, most of which will be located in areas of instability, political corruption and intrigue, and conflict. As I suggested, this will naturally favor geopolitical struggle as leaders of the major consuming nations seek to enhance their country's position in this struggle vis-a-vis other competing consuming nations. And this means, in practice, forging political military alliances with major supplying nations in the producing areas of the world so as to assure their loyalty and reliability. For the United States, this, for example, this has entailed a special relationship with the Saudi royal family, entitling the United States to obtain Saudi oil at a discount in return for U.S. protection of the royal family, a relationship that stretches all the way back to FDR, who, as I indicated, had a unique perspective on geopolitics, and lies at the heart of the U.S. military policy in the Persian Gulf area. When President Bush, the first President Bush, announced U.S. intervention in the first Persian Gulf War in 1990, he did not talk about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam Hussein's dictatorial behavior in his earliest speeches. Rather, he talked about the threat posed by Iraqi forces in Kuwait to Saudi Arabia's oil and the flow of oil through the Persian Gulf, in line with the Carter Doctrine of 1980, and he said that the United States had to draw a line in the sand and prevent any further assault on the oil production of Saudi Arabia. And this was the basis on which the U.S. intervened. The United States has also established military ties with other leading oil producers, including Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, Colombia, Nigeria, and a number of other countries, and also with oil transit nations like Georgia, as I indicated earlier. By the very same token, China has now also militarized its ties with many of its leading energy providers, including Iran, Sudan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan. Like us, providing them with arms, military equipment, and military services. It's established a particularly close ties with the Sudanese government, providing it with arms, military training, military equipment, some of which is believed to have been used by the Sudanese to suppress the revolt in the southern part of the country and the rebellion in Darfur. China has even created a new regional security organization, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO, which has become an important arm of China's energy-related geopolitical drive in Central Asia. Russia is also a member of the SCO and has cooperated with China in efforts to contain U.S. influence in the Central Asian region. As I indicated, Russia also seeks to contest U.S. efforts to exclude Russia from the transportation of Caspian Sea oil and gas to the West. In so doing, it has relied on the full menu of military instruments, including arms transfers, military training programs, and the maintenance of military bases in the region. So now you have a three-way competition for geopolitical influence in Central Asia and the Caspian, with the United States, China, and Russia all deeply involved, all supplying arms and military advisors, and two, Russia and the United States maintaining military bases and force deployments in the region. The only thing that I can think of to compare with this is the three-way struggle for geopolitical influence in the Balkans and the Middle East prior to World War I. This, in essence, is where we stand today. Assuming current trends persist in the United States, China, Japan, and other industrial powers, and we continue to rely on military means to acquire overseas energy supplies, we can continue to expect a bitter geopolitical struggle over access to whatever energy supplies remain available for exploitation. And as I've indicated, most of these remaining supplies are located in areas of instability and conflict, and this means that any intrusion of outside rivalry and competition will intersect with the historic divisions and antagonisms that exist within these regions. And these are the perfect conditions for the outbreak of regional conflict and great power war. And this, as I said, is exactly what happened in the Caucasus in August. And in my mind, this is precisely the sort of scenario that would trigger a major international conflict like the one that triggered World War I. If we're to avert this sort of scenario, we need more than a few revisions of our energy policy. We need an entirely new strategy for energy acquisition and consumption in the United States. Such a strategy, I believe, must proceed from two basic assumptions. First, it is essential to end oil's predominance in America's energy mix and establish a much more diversified energy strategy. Oil now provides 40% of our total energy supply, compared to 23% each for coal and natural gas. This is far more than any other major economy. No other country, no other major economy, other than the Middle Eastern countries that produce oil, relies so disproportionately on oil for their major supply of energy. And this is a truly unsustainable proportion. Not only because the world supply of oil will soon begin to contract, but because we cannot produce enough oil from domestic sources of supply to meet our needs, and so we'll become ever more reliant on increasingly problematic and unreliable foreign suppliers, leading to the kinds of conflicts that I described. On top of this, oil is a major, the consumption of oil is a major source of carbon dioxide emissions, and virtually every scientist agrees that we must curb our emissions of carbon dioxide if we're to avert the worst effects of global warming. So we must reduce our reliance on petroleum, and we must do so relatively quickly. This means developing alternative sources of energy, especially renewable sources of energy. And we could talk about what the various options are. I'm not going to put forward a particular favored one, but you know what the choices entail. Advanced biofuels, wind and solar power, and so on. Let's talk about those in the question and answer session. But the goal has to be reduce our consumption of petroleum and the development of petroleum alternatives. That's half of what we have to do. The other half of what we have to do is to embrace a new foreign energy policy based on cooperation rather than confrontation. If we continue to view the procurement of overseas energy supplies as a zero-sum game with national security implications, as we do today, we will condemn ourselves to a costly and dangerous game of geopolitical confrontation, which will produce constant crisis and conflict without actually increasing America's net energy supply. If you look at all of the instances in which the United States has used military force to protect the flow of oil, and then seen just exactly what outcome it's produced in terms of increasing our energy supply, I wager that you will find that the net effect has been negligible. In fact, I would argue that the very use of military force to protect overseas supply of oil has done more harm than good, because it inevitably is viewed by the populations of the countries in which we deploy our forces as an act of intrusion, of imperialism, if you will, of an assault on their of their homeland or of their religion, and thus is exploited by our enemies, especially Al-Qaeda, to recruit enemies, recruit soldiers into terrorist organizations and the like, and thus creates more hostility, more antagonism to the United States. And I think that's been the record of the past few decades. So I think the militarization of our reliance on imported oil is a net loss for the United States, simply in the stated goals of protecting the flow of oil. In addition, the notion that we should engage in a competition with China over access to imported oil, for example, in Africa, which is now appears to be underway, or in other parts of the world, will prove exceedingly costly for both of our countries, draining funds away from investment in the development of energy alternatives. So it seems to me that our primary foreign policy goal should be in the next administration, whoever is president, should be to turn away from confrontation over energy with China and other energy competitors, and to move in the direction of cooperation with these countries. We should cooperate with China in the development of promising energy alternatives, thereby sharing the costs of developing these alternatives, but more importantly, averting the risk of war over energy and reducing the expenditure that we would otherwise spend on a new arms race with China over access to energy, perhaps more importantly. On top of that, we have to worry that China is overtaking us as the world's leading emitter of carbon dioxide, primarily because of its heavy reliance on coal as a source of energy. We have a national security interest in working with China to reduce its emissions of carbon dioxide through its coal use. It's essential to our survival to do so. That means, I believe, that we should cooperate with China in developing climate-safe coal technologies and renewable sources of energy so that China moves away from its heavy reliance on coal or unsafe uses of coal for our mutual benefit. So it seems to me that cooperation rather than confrontation with China over energy is essential for our benefit as well as theirs. In conclusion, then, I believe that these two tasks, the reduction of our reliance on petroleum and the switch to a more diversified energy system that will make it unnecessary for us to engage in a geopolitical struggle with other countries for a diminishing supply of overseas energy resources on the one hand, and the development of a cooperative energy strategy alliance with China on the other hand, are the most important domestic on one hand, foreign policy on the other hand, priorities for the next American president and his successors. And I'll leave you with that and now invite your comments and questions. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Michael, I'd like to start the conversation by pursuing your comments on coal a little bit. Here in Virginia, of course, we produce a lot of coal. We ship a lot of coal from our ports, and we perhaps have a greater understanding of the potential of coal than others might. We're also very sensitive to the climate aspects of coal, the dangers to our environment of coal. Do you think that our energy policy, our domestic energy policy, ought to be more focused on developing appropriate clean coal technologies? Should that be the first place our domestic energy policy resources go, or should it be broader based?
First of all, it's clear that there is no single energy solution. Everything tells us that we need a diversified energy policy that seeks to solve many problems. And coal will have to play a role in our future energy strategy, at least in the short term. And I don't know how long the short term will last. We don't know. Nobody could stand in front of this room. Nobody could stand in front of this room and tell you what the ideal solution will be, because nobody knows the answer to that question. I wish somebody could tell you that in 25 years we will have a hydrogen economy that will solve all of our problems, or a future form of nuclear power, fusion power, that will solve all our problems, or that solar power will solve all of our problems, but nobody could tell you that. And if they did, they would be misleading you. So we have to use a combination of best effects. Now, about coal, I distinguish between clean coal and safe coal. Clean coal, as I understand it, is coal that removes the pollutants. But carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. It is a threat to the environment. I talk about safe coal, which is coal that's safe for the environment. And at this point, that technology is still in a very primitive stage. So unless we can develop safe coal, I think we have to think about alternatives to coal use. However, the problem is, as I indicated, that China relies so heavily on coal, and they're not going to turn away from it. So it's crucial for both of us that we invest in the development of safe coal technologies.
Yesterday, the New York Times published an article debating the appropriate role of OPEC during this financial crisis. And I was wondering if you could share your views on OPEC's role in possibly setting a cap on oil prices during this difficult financial times.
Well, OPEC has its own interests. As I indicated, the oil-producing countries have interests different from ours. Their interests are to maximize their return on their product and to keep that return coming for as long as possible into the future. Our interest as consumers is to keep the price as low as possible and to satisfy our short-term needs. I think we should stop worrying about their needs and concentrate on our needs. And our needs, I believe, is not to worry about the short term so much and to worry about the long term. And what all the signals are telling us, it seems to me, is that petroleum's day is coming to a close, and we should do everything we possibly can to accelerate the transition to not to the end of petroleum, but to the day in which petroleum will play a much smaller role in our total energy mix. So what OPEC does, to my mind, is immaterial.
Hi. My question is not really about your prescriptions, about your recommendations, but more about your analysis.
Yes.
You paint a picture of the rise of mercantilism, or geopolitical mercantilism. But I think your analysis overlooks a key flaw. I mean, you draw these historical analogies to Malthus, Thayer Mahan, World War I. But since then, we've had this incredible rise of the global market, the political construction of a global market of oil as a commodity, namely in the 1980s. So in order for the geopolitics that you foresee to become enacted, key tenets of this global market would have to be abandoned. How do you see that working? How do you see suppliers going against, no doubt, politically contextualized financial interests and going against norms of a global market in the rise of multinational corporations in the 70s and 80s to enact the sort of vision that you're painting about geopolitics?
Thank you. Interesting question. Well, first of all, oil is not a regular commodity, never has been, never will be. So it's not part of international commerce. Oil is a strategic commodity. That is to say, it is viewed by governments as having a national security capacity. Bear in mind, the world's single largest consumer of oil is the U.S. Department of Defense. The U.S. Department of Defense uses more oil every day than the entire country of Sweden. So bear that in mind. We have always said that oil is essential to U.S. national security, and therefore we will go to war if necessary to ensure an adequate supply of oil. That makes it different, and it has always been different. That means that the state will intervene whenever necessary. Every nation on Earth follows the same model. So oil has always been controlled by state interests. There's no country that views oil differently. It is not governed by the rules of free trade or international commerce. A point in Case in point was the critical decision, disastrous decision, by the US Congress in 2005 to deny the Chinese company Sinopec the opportunity to purchase the Unocal Corporation, which was then up for sale on national security grounds. Many of you may recall that decision in a competition with Chevron. By free trade rules, by multinational corporation rules, Sinopec, which bid $2 billion more than Chevron, the other suitor, should have gotten it. But Congress stepped in, and the Bush administration, free trade Bush administration, did nothing, and Congress voted on national security grounds to deny Sinopec access to Unocal Corporation. As a result, China has said that the United States cannot be relied on issues of energy to play fair in international markets, and has increasingly pursued a nationalistic geopolitical game of forming an energy alliance with Russia, trying to drive the United States out of Central Asia. So the answer is that oil does not follow the rules of the free trade, international, multinationalized global market. Nor does natural gas, nor does uranium, nor do other primary sources of energy.
You and many others have made reference to a so-called hydrogen economy. Absent the successful development of a fusion power source, which does not appear to be on the horizon, or in fact does not even appear possible, hydrogen is nothing more than a fuel energy storage means. Hydrogen cannot be considered a primary source of energy. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, you're quite right. Hydrogen, it does not exist in a natural state, so it has to be extracted from water or from natural gas or some other material. If we can find a way to do this in a climate-friendly economic way, hydrogen shows great promise. But we don't at present have the ways to do that in a climate-friendly economic fashion. There are people who say that in time we could overcome these barriers, and then hydrogen under those circumstances shows great promise. So I favor, along with others, research into overcoming the barriers to using hydrogen. But as I said, nobody could stand in front of this room and tell you that that's attainable within a realistic time frame. I just favor continuing to pursue this as a possibility.
Thank you for a very, very interesting talk. This morning's paper has an article on the formation of an OPEC-like a consortium of natural gas-producing countries. I do remember the early 50s when the price of oil was 50 cents, when we were paying 50 cents a barrel before the creation of OPEC. Now we have the creation of this new consortium consisting of Russia, Qatar, and Iran for gas. Your comments on that, please. What's that going to do to the price of gas, of natural gas?
Yes, thank you. I talk about the potential for a natural gas OPEC in my new book. This again reflects a phenomenon that I mention in my talk, the determination of the energy producers to gain more control over their product and the transportation of their product. Vladimir Putin and Mr. Ahmadinejad of Iran and the other natural gas producers have been talking about a natural gas OPEC for quite some time. And I didn't know that they've moved further on this project, but this does reflect their desire to wrest more control. And this is part of a larger trend, a shift in the balance of power from the consuming nations to the producing nations. It will result not only in higher prices, but in greater political control. And I think that's as much as what's at stake here as the economic, you know, the pricing mechanism. Russia and Iran are consolidating their pipelines, and this is to frustrate efforts by the EU to build alternative pipelines, in which Georgia was the key, because Georgia was the only sort of alternative route for the construction of a pipeline bypassing Russia or Iran for Caspian Sea. The countries in between these are Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan, which also have natural gas. Now these will be forced to join this consortium. Their oil will have to go through the pipeline network controlled by Gazprom. This will further diminish the EU's independence in energy and concentrate more power in Russia's hands. Again, it's a geopolitical as well as an economic struggle that's underway.
I think your analysis is remarkably complete. I think your proposed policies are right on target. There is one factor that I didn't hear you mention directly, and that is, what will happen when the production starts to go down? We've been on a plateau for 4 years now, and about constant production, and there are still people who doubt that the production will go down. That's they're believing in long-term production of oil. When that production starts to go down in a couple of years, I believe there will be a special thing that will happen. Suddenly, the doubters will be refuted. They will realize they were wrong, and everybody will believe that oil is going to run out. When that happens worldwide, I think there will be the rise of nationalistic movements. I can cite, for example, Canada. It's pretty obvious that Canada would do better to keep more of its oil in country and quit importing into Ontario, for example. It would be no surprise to see some party in Canada, say the NDP party, adopt a policy of Albertan oil for Canada. And you can imagine similar movements in countries all over the world saying, save that oil for our grandkids. When that happens, the United States is going to be in terrible trouble because we depend too much on imported oil. I'm asking what you think about the potential for nationalism to cause an even worse problem or to be a really critical factor in a crisis.
Oh, there's absolutely no question about what you say. I mean, because we see signs of that already. Saudi Arabia, the world's most important oil producer is Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, which has long exported its crude, and stopped at that, is worried about the fact that it has a huge population of young people with no jobs, and worried about the political turbulence that could produce, a la Al-Qaeda, for example. And so is now insisting that more and more of that oil stay at home and be used to produce petrochemicals. So it's investing in all kinds of oil and gas-related industries. So less and less of it will be exported, and more of it will stay at home. This is happening already. So what you say is entirely true. There will be, even if the oil doesn't decline, the amount of exportable oil is beginning to decline. And we're going to see the consequences of that already for us. So this is a big problem. The impact will be reflected in the higher price of gasoline because there'll be less available on the market. This will produce demands to tear up every square inch of American territory and offshore to extract whatever there is. But, you know, the fact is there isn't that much, I believe, out there to extract, whether it's in Alaska or the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico or off the coast of Virginia. But these are acts of desperation. I've tried to say, there is no future in petroleum. And, you know, and we will, painfully or not, have to adjust to that reality. And I'm not saying it's going to disappear. It'll be a slow decline. There will be additive, there will be supplements in the form of tar sands from Canada and some shale oil, if the obstacles could be overcome, that will slow the decline, but there will be no way, but there will be a decline. And it will have a dramatic impact on American civilization and the American economy. So, you know, that's why I say we have to begin now the transition to a more diversified energy system.
Jack Brown is a professor in the University of Virginia's Department of Science, Technology, and Society.
Thank you, George. Thank you for a great talk, Michael. Those of us who are old enough to go back to 1973 remember that we got cold then with the oil shocks. Then American public policy called for energy independence, something we've gone nowhere with ever since. The phrase has come back, however. Could you discuss with us, though, how some of the nations of Western Europe and perhaps the Japanese responded to the 73 and 79 shocks? Is there any cause for optimism in public policies developed in those national governments in response to rising scarcity in oil?
They've done things, some things that I admire and some things that I'd be wary of, but we all have to look at those models to see what we might want to borrow and what we wouldn't. France and Japan responded by vastly increasing their reliance on nuclear power. But they did so in societies where local democratic processes were ridden roughshod over, if I express that well. You know, in France, local communities, states, municipalities, and counties weren't consulted where they locate a nuclear reactor. They said, we're going to put one there. And if you don't like it, tough. And if you protest, you know, we're going to cart you away. And that's the way, it's as simple as that. Ditto in Japan. These are decisions by fiat of the central government. In this country, we give local government and local citizens a voice in this decision, and I believe that that's essential for the preservation of democracy. For nuclear power to have a renaissance in this country on a scale that they have in France and Japan, there will have to be a substantial erosion of local democracy. And, you know, I think of Virginia. I've been to Williamsburg as a place that places strong emphasis on local democracy. I think that's precious, but we would have to give that up. And you folks in this room and people listening and the rest of America have to make a decision if we want to do that. On the other hand, France and Europeans and the Japanese made a huge investment in high-speed rail and other forms of public transportation. That's the envy of the world, and I wish we could do that here. So there are things to admire and things to worry about.
Is there any research in the United States into wood gas or coal gas? I grew up in Sweden during the Second World War, and we had, of course, very, very little gasoline. It went all to the military. And on the farms, we had wood gas or charcoal gas aggregates. And you could manage both tractors and cars fairly well with it. It's not as strong as gasoline, but I think that could be a way to go as the United States produces so much wood.
I don't know the supply of wood is sufficient. We have, however, a large supply of coal, and there is research underway and there are some plants that are being built to use the, it's a German name, sorry, it escapes me, the Fischer-Tropsch, is that right, process to developed by Germans and heavily used during World War II and also in South Africa during the UN embargo to convert coal into diesel fuel. So that there's a possibility of doing that as a fuel. Now, the same problem applies to that as and the use of wood is that these are carbon dioxide emitting processes. So unless you do this, assuming that the other environmental issues are addressed, but you have to address the carbon dioxide implications, and with the use of coal, you have to do this in a climate safe way. And so it's the same problem as with general coal use. However, if we can find a way to do this in a coal in a carbon safe way, then I think it's worth pursuing. But these are acts of desperation. You're talking about World War II. That was an act of desperation. The Germans, the South Africans did it because they were desperate. I think we shouldn't grasp for desperate measures. We should be moving away from petroleum and petroleum substitutes and doing something smarter, like building railroads.
I hope that our new president and the new Secretary of Energy and the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Transportation all will be deeply informed by Michael Clare's very clear thinking. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll be right back.